Tonight, personally speaking, our guest is the great actor Richard Thomas, who's starring as Atticus in To Kill a Mockingbird around the country. Please stay with us. Hello, I'm Monsignor Jim Lasanti. Welcome to Personally Speaking. Today, our guest is the Emmy Award-winning actor Richard Thomas. Richard is still recognized around the world for his Emmy-winning role as John Boy Walton in the iconic television series The Waltons. His television credits include The Americans, Billions, and the Netflix series Ozark. Richard earned a Tony nomination for his performance in The Little Foxes, and his many other Broadway credits include You Can't Take It With You, The Front Page, and An Enemy of the People. He's currently portraying Atticus Finch in Aaron Sorkin's adaptation of the national tour of To Kill a Mockingbird. The time-honored story focuses on the serious issues of rape and inequality, and Richard's role as Atticus Finch has served as a moral hero for many readers and a model of integrity for generations of lawyers. Richard's here with us today to talk about his life, his career, his family, the values that sustain him, and the very crucial and timely message in To Kill a Mockingbird. Joining me now, I'm so pleased to welcome to Personally Speaking the wonderful actor Richard Thomas. Richard Thomas is our guest. We're delighted to have him back. We were together years ago. Richard, first of all, with this national tour of To Kill a Mockingbird for our listeners and watchers around the country, where can they go to see you playing Atticus?
You can go to see me playing Atticus all over the country. We started our tour in March in Buffalo, and we finish next July in Hartford, Connecticut. And between then and to the time to come, we're going to be all over the place. Right now, we're in Memphis.
Okay.
Right, at the Orpheum Theater. And then after that, we go to Des Moines, Iowa for a week. Then we get a week off, and then we head to Salt Lake City. So if you want to find out, you can just go on the To Kill a Mockingbird tour website and find out. Okay. I'm sure you have all that information.
We have all that information. We'll make sure we get that in the introduction. But let me ask you, just actors I know who live in Manhattan and do a Broadway show and are doing 8 shows a week, to go from their apartment to backstage, they think can be an exhausting experience. To travel around the country with this show, how exhausted or wiped out are you after doing it?
Well, first of all, to walk out of my New York apartment, I would walk about, 10 minutes and be in the theater. There's nothing exhausting about that at all. That's right. That's like working in your own backyard. Touring is a very challenging experience. And this is my third national tour. I always wanted to try it. And I tried it initially with 12 Angry Men about 14 years ago. And I loved it. It was a wonderful experience. We went out twice with it. And then I toured again with The Humans a few years back. When the auspices are right and the play's right and the production's right and the people are right, it's a great experience, but it is challenging. Mm-hmm. Last week we were in Nashville, and then we have a 5-show weekend. So, we have Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night. Then we have 2 shows Saturday, 2 shows Sunday. Monday we travel. Our day off is our travel day, and then we open in the next city on a Tuesday after some rehearsal and sound checks and load in. So it's like the circus going from town to town. It's a great experience, but it is challenging.
Do you have friends all around the country? I mean, do you socialize when you travel, or are you so exhausted by doing the show that there's not much time for interpersonal relations?
I do have friends all around, not everywhere, thank heaven. As much as I enjoy having my friends come to see the show or be around, it's also, that's a little bit of work too. So when I get to a city where I don't know anybody, I'm always very relieved. But whenever I can, I love to have people come see the show. A couple things, this is a big show. It's a 3-hour mm-hmm. play, and it's a big part. And I'm not, an ingenue anymore. So my behavior, which is always very monkish when I'm doing a play, is even more so at this point. But also, you know, with COVID and our COVID precautions and all that, I'm very, very careful about socializing and going places. It's even more, my movements are even more restricted than they would normally be.
Richard Thomas is our guest. Richard, you just mentioned, you know, maintaining your energy level. And I didn't realize till I looked you up this past week that I'm 1952, you're 1951. I'm conscious of the fact that hard as I want to believe that I'm still 30, I'm not. And and neither are you. How have you handled the whole process? Because you look fine, you sound fine. How do you handle the process of aging? Does it intimidate in any way? Or is there a way to address the fact that we're all, if we're lucky, going there?
Well, all of the above, of course. You know, we start with genetics.
Yeah.
You know, we start with genetics, and so far I've been pretty lucky with that. And then you go to lifestyle, and I just try to be careful as much as I can. I mean, I'm, you know, full of vices and indolence and all that, but you know, that's delicious as well. Yeah. So I just try to do as little damage as possible with the hand I've been given to play, and. You know, I just stay very focused on the work, and I just try to keep it simple. But, you know, I look in the mirror every morning, and there's a little bit less of what I like and a little bit more of what I don't like.
So,
you know, we're all in the same boat. I'm just lucky to still be – not only am I lucky to still be around at 71, I'm lucky to be working so joyfully and with such satisfaction.
Richard, you mentioned the pandemic, which affected everyone, but I was very conscious of my friends in the arts community having, especially those who are stage actors, especially how to cope with the sudden end of their world. I went to see Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf one night, and the next night Broadway was closed. How did you handle, what did you do with all that found time?
Well, you know, it was devastating for players and people whose primary, you know, mode of existence and self-support is the theater. I mean, that was just a shutdown. For those of us who are fortunate enough to also work in front of the camera, those cameras got rolling quite a bit sooner. Mm-hmm. I was doing a movie, a Netflix picture in Canada when we shut down in, I think, March of 2020, and then we resumed it that fall. So my hiatus period from work was relatively short. However, from the theater, a long time.
Long time.
So it was punishing. But as I'm sure you noticed, you can't keep performers from performing because Zoom showed up, and like everywhere you turn, people were doing plays and doing, you know, concerts and, you know, I mean, all this stuff that, you know, people are just, actors are just going to keep acting.
Right. No, Zoom
but,
was,
acting
Zoom was
around
a
the house is not so good for the family. So I kept it as quiet as possible. And I didn't mind it. I mean, I was a lucky one. So, you know, we were all, I mean, the biggest challenge was To Kill a Mockingbird, because we were scheduled to go out in August of 2020. Yeah. So it was going to be like, okay, are we going to go? When are we going to go? If we don't go, is the tour going to be canceled? Is it going to be pushed? So we all hung in, and thank heaven, you know, we've been going strong for 6 months now, and we've had the odd case here and there, you know, but we're very prepared to deal with that. And I just am so grateful to the powers that be that everybody hung in and kept this tour, you know, alive.
Richard, you said a moment ago that a lot of what happens in our aging process is because of good genes. I'm living down the hall from my 101-year-old mom, so I appreciate that. But let me ask you, your parents, in terms of what they gave you, for which you're grateful?
Well, life, first of all, number one, love. And one without the other isn't so great. It's kind of a matched set. A lot of education about, I mean, I had a happy childhood, you know, with a lot of exceptions, like everybody else. Right. I don't want to idealize it, but I have, when I think of my childhood, it makes me happy. But when I started acting at a very young age, you know, when I began performing it, like, well, originally at six, and then as a member of Actors Equity at seven, because my parents were dancers, they were in the ballet, and they had been on the stage for, you know, a long, long time. I really they were stage parents in the best sense. They really were there to help me through, and I learned so much about how to go to work and about how to, you know, about the discipline of working and the values of work. And so that when things started to get successful for me, it wasn't crazy. It was just going to work. And because they'd really helped me learn how to just go to work. And as long as you look at what you're doing as just your job and your work and what you love to do, if you're lucky, then the other things that are going to come your way, if you have success, are not going to be quite as distorting. So they were very, in terms of the values of having work and career, the values around work, they were really helpful for me about that. And then, of course, the example of all the people I worked with.
Richard Thomas is our guest. Richard, 2 weeks ago, our guest was Billy Gray, who played Bud on Father Knows Best.
Wow. And
like yourself, you know, a childhood actor. But he says that rather than being damaged by it, as you hear some horror stories, that it gave him great confidence that if he at 6 or 7 could do what he did, that nothing in life would intimidate him. In you, did it build a natural confidence?
I think that the performance personality, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily extroverted, that's a misunderstanding of what the performance person. Performance personality is mostly about problem solving, mm-hmm. And improvisation. You know, figuring it out as it goes along, because as you're performing, things are coming your way, and you're having to constantly make adjustments and all that, and that's how you function. But performers are, in terms of their instinct to perform, are quite an energetic lot. Mm. If you see children who have a gift for performance, they are very forthright and they're strong. You know, they're very confident. They're very clear about what they want to do. And I think I shared in that as well. But that doesn't mean that carries into all other aspects of your life. Sometimes the beautiful thing about performing is that's really where you feel safest. That's safe haven. I mean, the stage probably is this. For me, the safest place in the world. When I walk on stage or into a theater, I feel like I'm, you know, I know exactly where I am. I know exactly what I have to do. I know exactly what everybody else has to do. And it's a good, secure container.
Yeah.
And it isn't that way for everybody. But I think that this sort of natural confidence that young performers have is just part of who we are. I love it. I mean, I was fortunate in that, although I was clearly, you know, eager as a young person, as a child, and talented, you know, able to do it and able to learn. My parents, they weren't stage parents in the other sense. I wasn't ever pushed into it, or, you know, they weren't like managing a career and trying to get it was work. You know, I became a child who was working. So they helped me, you know, make those choices about work and what to do. But they were never part of a career machine. And in that respect, I was very, very lucky. I didn't get pushed. I was encouraged and I was guided, but I wasn't pushed. They had their own careers. I was not their vicarious success story.
Right. They had their own success too. Richard, when I mentioned to people that you were going to be a guest on the program today, there's this kind of universal reaction to you, your name. Maybe it goes back to the John Boy stuff, but oh my God, what a nice guy. They paint you, whether they know you or not, as this quintessential nice guy. And that is the way you come across. That is the way you're perceived. Are you that nice?
I have no idea. I'm not nice enough, in my opinion. You know, I mean, you can ask the question, is it nice to be nice?
Right.
I'm always, every day, no matter how many times a day, it's like, oh, I could have been nicer there. I could have been nicer there. You know, it's nice to know people think I'm nice. I just try to get through the day hurting as few people as I can.
Well, you're doing a good job, apparently. They think you're a lovely man. Now, Richard Thomas is, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, around the country. We'll announce later on some of the locations for To Kill a Mockingbird. But now, you know, it's obviously a story about race, and it's a story about justice and social justice. But one of the things that I think is most attractive about it, both in book, movie, and stage play, is the experience of Atticus as parent. You know, might surprise people who don't know your personal story, but Richard, in some ways, is responsible for 7 children in his personal life. What kind of parent do you think you've turned out to be? And when you look at Atticus, what might we learn from his parenting skills?
When you say I was responsible for 7, that's a terrifying.
My
blood ran cold when you said that. And you know, and they're all in varying states of disrepair because of me, I'm sure. But yes, what I like to tell people, because there is such an emphasis, and rightfully so, on the racial and social justice aspect of To Kill a Mockingbird, that sometimes people pass over the other half of the story, which is, of course, it's the story of children losing innocence and coming to terms with the way the world is growing up. And it's also about Atticus losing, certainly in the way that Aaron Sorkin has brilliantly adapted this production and Bart Scheer has directed it. It's also about Atticus losing his innocence as well. Atticus has been so beautifully humanized in this version that it's a gift to any actor. People say, what does it feel like to play an icon? And I mean, you can't play an icon. Icons are unplayable. They belong, you know, on the wall in a church. You can't play an icon. You can only play a human being. And Aaron Sorkin just took Atticus down off the pedestal and gave him a wonderfully human and vulnerable story to tell, which is a boon to any actor, all of us who have played and will continue playing the role. But a big part of this show is about childhood. And it's about Atticus being a single father who is, along with Calpurnia, who is the homemaker, really, and who's worked for the family for so many years. The two of them are really raising these kids together, and he is a single dad in many ways. And the challenges of giving his children a sense of idealism and a sense of values, but also allowing them to find their own opinions and their own ideas about the world. Because the play is so much about, it's our picture of us as a country, and probably a picture of any country. Any country has these things to deal with. But how do we maintain our idealism and our aspirations to be our better selves, but still see the world as it really is?
Wow.
In other words, when we talk about community, we are a community of people, but we cannot paint the community in one color. Atticus has to learn who his community is. So it's like, okay, we're good people. Everybody's a good person. He has a good view of the world. He has a wonderfully optimistic view of life. But if that keeps you from seeing the world as it really is, then it's not helpful. Mm-hmm. So how do we maintain our idealism without becoming cynical? That's the great question. And I think he's trying to teach his children this.
Yeah. Richard Thomas is our guest. Richard, during the pandemic, one of our guests was Mary Badham, who, of course, had played Atticus's daughter in the movie version. And interestingly enough to me, she said that until the end of his life, they had a kind of daughter-father relationship, that he stayed in touch with her because she didn't have her father had died early on. I mention that because you helped to create this ongoing community, especially with the national tour. I'm told by actor after actor that they become almost like a family to you. Yeah. I think that's beautiful, but I'm wondering how then do you move past that? Like you form this intimacy. You've been a stage actor among many other dimensions of your acting career. You have this closeness, daily working with people, getting close to them, understanding them, knowing them personally. How do you end that?
Okay, so we have situational bonding. You know, we come together for a period of time. And in order to do the work we do, which involves a profound degree of emotional trust, because we all get out, and we are a family. One of the things I love about the theater, I felt it as a child around the ballet, my parents' world, and I've always felt it around my world. You do create a family. You do make a family. Mm. And, you know, nobody's the daddy, but it's a family. And it's founded on trust. People must trust each other on stage and off. They must feel that everyone is out there for each other, and that the ensemble is the most important aspect of the whole. thing. So you do create this family. And in order to do that, and actors are emotionally very available people for the most part and eager to, they're people people. So we form these very intense situational bonds, right? And it's very difficult to say goodbye, especially after a very long time like this. You will remain bonded to everybody. But there is usually a handful of people with whom you will continue to maintain a relationship. And that's just because of personal affinities. Or, you know, if you've had a particularly wonderful experience working together and you have personality affinities that work. So that's a natural thing anyway. You're going to make friends. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to make eternal friends with everybody.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the bonding that takes place during the work time isn't real, because it is real. The caring and the love, which is the only word I can use for it, that makes a company come alive on stage in the most supportive way, that is a very precious and real thing. It's not fake. It's not pretend. The Waltons, you know, I think that one of the reasons that show was so successful was that we loved each other. We were a family. Mm. It was on screen and it was real. And we still love each other. We're still in touch with each other. We're still an extended family. So I think if a company can create this sense of mutuality and mutual empathy and trust, then the bond that we have will carry to the audience, will communicate itself. You know, theater is really about what it is to be human. And I like to think of theater as an empathy machine. Mm-hmm. And in order to create that climate for the people in the room and in the audience, you have to have it on stage as well. Or it's best if you can have it on stage as well.
You know, Richard, because we are contemporaries, we went through the 1960s together in terms of watching this country explode and inflame over issues of racial justice. And I guess I thought we'd come a long way. And then 2020 comes, George Floyd dies, and you see cities burning again. You wonder to yourself, how much progress have we made? What are you hoping a play like To Kill a Mockingbird can do in terms of finding a road to healing for our still unresolved feelings about racial relationships?
Well, it's a great question. And as I say, the play is a portrait of America, better and for worse. It people who come to see the play will see how far we've come and how far we have to go, because so much of it feels the same. And one of the brilliant things that I have to hand all this to Aaron Sorkin, because what he did without in any way betraying the spirit of the novel or Harper Lee's intentions, what he did was he brought the play forward in terms of thematic focus and in terms of the lens through which we're viewing social justice today.
You know, many years ago, the first guest I think I ever interviewed was the film director Frank Capra. And he used to say that physical illness was nothing compared to the greatest illness of mankind, discouragement. And that's where I want to end the interview. You look at our country, you look at our world, you look at what's going on between Putin and Ukraine and everything else around the world that seems to be so unjust and violent. You embrace Buddhism as a way to lead the world to kindness. I'm just wondering, Richard Thomas, not as an actor who's starring in To Kill a Mockingbird, but as a person who's an observer of life, which makes you the better actor that you are, are you a man of hope, Richard?
Look, it's a very discouraging time. this is a discouraging time. I mean, it's weird, isn't it? It's like it happens in our personal lives. Things are going along, and then all of a sudden, something horrible happens, or several things, and you're in a vortex of trouble. And it just is how it works. You know, it's the valences are constantly changing. And right now, you know, this is not good.
No, it's not.
This is not good. But if we handle it right, then maybe some things can become better. I think we have to see the world as it is and take whatever action we can and hope that it goes the way we want it. Hope is great, but there are many more efficacious ways to be alive than hoping. One can be determined. Optimism is different from hope in a way. Because I believe that things cannot really be any other way than the way they are. And so each moment being exactly the way it's supposed to be gives us a clue as to how to take the next step forward so that things can be the way they are supposed to be in a different way. Does that make any sense at all?
It makes great sense. You know, I used to be the director of an organization called the Christophers. Their motto was better to light one candle than to curse the darkness. Is this world with all of its conflict?
I completely agree with this.
That's what you do, Richard. That's what you do.
Well, you're very kind.
No, it's true. Whether it's John Boy or Atticus, that's what you've been doing so much of your life. What Thomas Paine. You bring hope. You light that one candle. You don't just curse the darkness and give in to discouragement. So thank you, not just for your wonderful acting career, but for the person you are and the hope you give us. And for our listeners and watchers around the world, I was blessed to be able to see you a couple of times To Kill a Mockingbird on the Broadway stage. That's not possible anymore. So the best way of all in the whole world to go see it is to go see Richard in it right now. So Richard, we're going to encourage our listeners by telling them where it's showing around the country. But thank you for bringing us Atticus once again. And thank you for you.
Well, I love this interview. I'm your kindness makes me blush. So I really appreciate it. And I'm loving this play. I could not be bringing a more important thing around the country than this. So if it's a candle, I'd like to go from city to city and light as many candles as I can.
And you're doing that. Thank you, Richard. Thank you so much. And enjoy those beautiful seven children that you're responsible for.
Oh, absolutely. They're my great treasures.
As we end today's program, I want to thank you all for being with us. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me at personallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. To listen to this show or other episodes, go to YouTube and search under Personally Speaking with Monsignor Jim Lasanti, where you'll be able to watch our shows as well. And don't forget, please, to hit like and subscribe. Personally Speaking is also on Facebook at Personally Speaking with Monsignor Jim Lasanti, and we're now also on Instagram at Personally Speaking Podcast. Please share and let others know about Personally Speaking. I'm privileged to serve as host and executive producer, Personally Speaking. Our producer is Lisa Janovitz. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be with you again next time on Personally Speaking.